Les conférences du Collège de France.
I will start because at 10:58 professionally on said that we're coming from his office, so as Claude said, maybe there are some traffic jams and coming back from there. So anyway, the last three lectures are going to be in a topic completely different than what I spoke last time. And all three are going to be joint work with Pierre Cardellaguer and George Action, who is a postdoc in Chicago. So there will be about a similar problem in the background, something defined on a bounded set, and there will be different phenomena. So this one is going to be about absorption, while the next one is going to be about stopping, and the last one is going to be about the so-called Fleming-VO process. So the idea behind all these talks is how one handles the boundary. Okay, so figure out. Okay. All right, so in the background, we have a mean field stochastic control problem where there is a central planner who controls a large number of particles, and each of these particles is absorbed when they hit the boundary of a smooth bounded domain. So once it hits the boundary, one of the particles go. The value of this n particle problem is going to be described by what we call a hierarchy of Hamilton-Jacobi equations. So which, depending on the number of particles, we start with n, and it has to do with how many particles are left in the game. And they are coupled, these equations are coupled through the boundary conditions. And the value function of the large particle limit, so eventually we're going to let the number of particles go to infinity, will solve a Hamilton-Jacobi-Bellman equation set on the space of subprobability measures on a domain. And all the work about the paper is how to deal with this PDE on when you are not working anymore with probability measures, but subprobability measures. So the main contributions of the work is a comparison principle for the infinite dimensional Hamilton-Jacobi equation and a convergence result for the value of the n particle system as n goes to infinity. We don't have a rate for that. We haven't tried to find a rate, so that's an open problem. So let me describe the system now. We're doing the simplest possible way, so we have the original system has n particles. All of them evolve according to the. I overdid it. Okay, so all of them evolve with this stochastic differential equation. Alpha I is a control for the I particle, and these things move as long as they till the first time they hit the boundary. So tau I is the first time the ith particle hits the boundary of the domain. The value function, if you're going to write down a value function for this problem, looks like that. So you start with the n particles, and you start losing particles as you go. So there is this running cost L, there is an interaction term F, and there is a terminal condition. And when I write there mn of xt, is the weighted empirical measure of VXT, because some of them go. So this is not a probability measure anymore, it's subprobability. The infimum, as always, is taking over the RD value processes alphas, which have some square integrability and some measurability with respect to the Brownian motions. The data of the problem are the forcing, the interaction, the terminal datum, G, and the Lagrangian, which gives rise to the Hamiltonian like that. And we are interested in understanding a PDE for the Vn, but the way the best way to do that is to change the problem now to a system with k equations, as we are going to see next. So for any k between 1 and n, we're looking now at the omega k valued process for the k particles, which evolve exactly the same way. And we have the associated with them, we have the VNK value, that now the sum is up to K, divided always by 1 over N. And the M is the weighted empirical measure of the K variable. So what you need, the infimum is taking over the same thing. So what you need to think is that the central planar, once it loses, when he loses or she loses a particle because it hit the boundary, restarts the process, having now K N minus 1 particles, and you keep going. And at every stage, every step, he has this, the central planar has this control problem up to K till it loses one more particle and keeps going. And this way we can write down the dynamic, we are restoring the dynamic programming principle, and we can write down an equation for that. So here is the system now. So we have what I call the hierarchy, as a lack of better word, it sounds, if nothing else, more serious when you say hierarchy. There are K values. Each one solves what you expect it to solve, the usual Hamilton-Jacobi equation, but up to K there. Remember, K is less than N, same terminal condition, and they are connected, all of them, but what happens on the boundary. So the picture, my co-authors don't like to think like that, like to think a smooth domain omega, but think that you are in in Rn, where the whole thing halves, and then you start looking at slices. So the Vn1 problem, if you start with the problem Rn, will be something defined on a square, and then it will be on the cube, and so on the surfaces. And it's not a single variable, it's not a single function Vn1 you have, but it's a collection of the V, it's a collection of functions on the boundary of that cube. And you keep going. So, of course, for one, you know exactly what it is. At zero, you need to initiate this somewhere. So at zero, it's just the propagation of the terminal condition. Zero here is the zero measure in the space of subprobability measures. And the classical notation for x minus one is the vector x when you remove the ith component. Okay, so the lateral boundary conditions, which is this, provides the only coupling, and can be understood in terms of dynamic programming. When a particle reaches the boundary, the central planar faces a new optimization problem with one fewer particle. So that's the equation we have, and as I said, the next talk is going to be a stopping time instead of hitting the boundary, and in the last talk the boundary conditions are going to be more complicated. Okay, so letting n go to infinity, you expect to get a mean field control game, a mean field control problem with a value function which should look like that, where now the M is a subprobability measure. The controls are pairs of M and alpha. The alphas have to have finite energy, and the M solves the usual Fokker-Planck type equation with zero boundary conditions, because once we stop at the boundary, it's done. And you interpret the solution in the sense of distributions. It's a standard mean field control problem, except for the fact that because of the M is zero on the boundary and we are in the bounded domain, you're going to lose mass. So the total mass of the can decrease in time. Okay, the expectation is, once you write this thing down, that there will be an infinite dimensional Hamilton-Jacobi-Bellman equation, which, for those of you, for all the experts in the room, we recognize it will look like that. And the only issue is to decide what happens to the boundary. And we claim that the correct boundary condition is that it's a Neumann in terms of the linear derivative of the boundary. So this is the infinite dimensional Hamilton-Jacobi-Bellman equation, and all our work is to define a notion of solution for this problem and prove that it's unique. Okay. Let me explain at least here why that condition seems to capture the coupling conditions I said earlier. So, and the boundary conditions we put. So the first one is simple, because remember the boundary conditions we are trying to recover or see that they are modeled by these are these two. So because at the terminal time at t equals zero, we are going to have that, you see the time derivative is there. This is a formal argument. At time capital t, you have this to be equal to f of zero if you start at zero. So it's clear that when you evaluate the solution at the zero measure, the formula will look like that, because nothing else sees that. And what about the Neumann condition? So I claim the Neumann condition is a natural analog of the lateral boundary condition, because if you were smooth, then the fact that this linear derivative is zero on the boundary means that you have this limit. It looked like, I should have put a limit there. There is a limit of the k minus 1, and so that means that when you are projecting the u and k down on the finite dimensions, you are going to have this boundary condition. So there is a limit there that I messed it up. Okay, so that's what it is. So the claim is that this Neumann condition is what you get. All right. A quick reminder, the calculus in the space of subprobability measures. It's a compact metric space if we use the version of the D1 norm, the D1 Wasserstein norm, which is, I wrote it there, so we have it. And as usual, we can derive a linear derivative on that space, subprobability measures in the classical way. And also to keep the notation, because we're going to be in a bounded domain, I also recall what is a Fresnel derivative in H minus 1. H minus 1 will be a space that will play a role. And we think of H minus 1 as the dual of H 0, 1 in this domain. And the notion of Fresnel derivative is the classical notion. Okay, so the main assumptions are that the domain is smooth. The forcing and the terminal conditions are also smooth and Lipschitz continuous. The Lagrangian is Lipschitz continuous in X, locally Lipschitz continuous in control variable, and it's convex. All these things together say that the Hamiltonian is smooth, convex in P with at most quadratic growth, and Lipschitz continuous in X and P, locally in P. Okay, so forget the last line. This is no matter how many times you proofread something escapes. All right, so what are the main results? First of all, about comparison. So the first result we prove is that if we assume that H is Lipschitz, and we don't see how to remove this Lipschitz condition. It looks silly, but stupid, but we need to assume that H is globally Lipschitz. Then we have a comparison between a subsolution and a supersolution. I haven't told you how we define them, but we expect to get a comparison under the Lipschitz continuous assumption. The value function that I defined is continuous in the usual way instead of in terms of the distance, the d distance in M and N, a Holder continuous in time, and it is the unique solution to the infinite dimensional Hamilton-Jacobi-Bellman equation. And the last one is the convergence, which is the way it's usually written, that if we project the solution to the infinite dimensional PDE on any of these M and X, K, X measures, so remember the K means that we are summing up to K and divide by N, then uniformly on K and in space-time, we have this convergence. So these are the three things I would like to describe a little bit. The real work is on the comparison. So first of all, some related work. It turns out that studying particles with systems with absorption is a very common problem, especially with or without common noise. And the canonical results you see is you have the domain is zero infinity. The absorption, of course, is at zero. And these are models that appear a lot in the modeling of systemic risk in finance, when absorption represents the default of a financial institution. And the reference is, I know the main person I know working there is Hambly at Oxford with former students and so on. And also Nadovsky and Skolnikov, who have used these ideas later with De La Rue to study free boundary problems. The convergence, the limit problem, but the limit property, the study of the mean field of the problem in infinite dimensions, but without convergence. There are two kinds of lines. One is a probabilistic perspective, which is basically by Campi and Fisher, and later, basically Campi is the main person there. And there is a model about master equation for a particular model in economics by Graber and Sirkar, a long paper that... Okay. So Hamilton, Jacobi, Bellman equation in the space of measures, that's even a more crowded area. Chronologically, I put Charles first, the 2023, and ending with some work with Dodin and Seeger, and Dodin, Jackson and Seeger more recently. And the convergence problem, again, has been studied, type of problem has been studied, there are qualitative results. Using typical qualitative results at the limit. And quantitative results is results where you obtain a rate. And again, there have been a number of works, not for this problem, but in general. Most of the problems I know of are for this rate, are in the whole domain, and so there's no boundary to see what happens. All right. To define test functions, to have a notion of solution for the problem with the Neumann condition, we need to have special test functions, and they are okay, they're smooth, so functions and together the derivatives, the linear derivatives exist and they are continuous with respect to the D norm, so that's not a big deal. The real condition we have to put on our test functions is that they have a zero linear derivative on the boundary. This is a restricted class of test functions, but we need it in order to be able to prove uniqueness. So let me give you an example of a smooth function like that. If phi of m is the minus s norm square of the h, which is hs is the dual of h0s then this function is indeed a smooth function up there, because when you compute its linear derivative of the boundary, it looks like that. Star means is the dual element, and that's zero on the boundary because you have the duality, which is zero s. Okay, so this is not an empty. The only reason I'm putting that here is to show you that this is not an empty class of test functions. We're going to use these test functions to prove the convergence, but we cannot use them to prove the comparison, so we're going to show that if you assume you have a solution with this definition, with these kinds of test functions, then you have this viscosity property for rougher solutions. Okay. All right, so now the issue is how to define the viscosity solution for this problem. Since we work with subprobability measure, it's not possible to use the classical two versus time distance. I'm thinking about uniqueness, I'm thinking about doubling variables, so anytime I say test function, I'm thinking of putting in something that sees the difference of two measures. So because we're in subprobability spaces, we cannot do that with a distance function, with a typical two versus time metric. I'm aware of some extensions of the Wasserstein distance to subprobability measures, but it's very hard to figure out what are the differentiability properties of this these distances. There is an attempt recently, there has been an attempt to work with smoother metrics, which you can obtain by embedding the superprobability space into a sufficiently negative Sobolev space. It's the example I gave you earlier. The problem with that is that at some point we're going to have to do some integration by parts in the problem. And therefore, if we use if we embed in H minus S, and S there has to be large, bigger than D plus 2 plus D over 2 plus 2, then not only the derivative is going to be zero, not only the derivative of the test function is going to be zero on the boundary, but all up to S minus 1 derivatives, which is really not appropriate, because in our problem, that's the only derivative we want to be zero. So what should be the right, the natural thing, which is H minus S, it's wrong for this problem. So in the end, we're going to prove the uniqueness using a rough metric, which is just the square of the H minus 1 norm. Remember, to have a smooth metric, a smooth function, I had to take S like that. So this is clearly not smooth in the definition we have. So we have to show that with the definition we have, we can actually use such kind of distance. And finally, we will also need to introduce the singular penalization in the problem by adding, subtracting the delta M squared, or M is the L2 norm, in order to bring some compactness properties and to enforce the boundary condition. This idea of when you're dealing with infinite dimensional problems to introduce some penalization, has been known from the work of Crandall and Jones on infinite dimensional spaces. Then also Tataru used it. And this is the key element of the work we developed with Charles and Pierre-Louis on the large deviations. We had to put something there. And then it has picked up. So many people, like the reference I mentioned with Dodin and Seeger and Dodin Jackson, and are using that. So I will explain that in a minute. All right, so here's the definition. So for a subsolution, the top property, it's no issue. We have to take something to be below the data initial condition. And then the real condition is the following, that there exists a constant C, a universal constant C, such that for any maximum of that quantity there, which is the smooth distance function, taking away, penalizing with the delta M, the square of the L2 norm, then any maximum of that, which we have to argue that exists, is in H01 and satisfies this inequality. Remember, I'm assuming H is Lipschitz. Now, for the subsolution property, Lipschitz is not necessary, because you can use convexity to prove this inequality. So on the left-hand side, we have the, which is the important thing, that's the quantity that gives you the H01, is we have the H01 norm. And that's why we're using this norm, to be able to be in H01. The subsolution, the supersolution property, we have to, this is where, as I said, we need to assume that the Hamiltonian is Lipschitz. It's similar, again, at the mean. Sorry, hold on a minute. PLV laughs with me when I do that, but I need to do it. So short break. So I apologize for that. So to state a definition like that, this is where we need to use that the Hamiltonian is Lipschitz, because why is that? Because in principle there will be a delta M inside there, and we need to pull it out. And in the subsolution property, because of convexity, we could do it. In the supersolution property, we cannot. We have to assume the Lipschitz continuity. This problem did not appear in the work for random matrices, because the dependence there is linear. So the error we make, we don't have to assume anything, because it just pops out as a linear term. While here, you have to take it out of the Hamiltonian. Okay, so that's the definition. Now, let me explain again a little bit more how this choice of test function is how these test functions encode the fact that the linear derivative should be zero there. So this has to do with the fact, follows from the fact, that the point we touch, either from above or below, in quotes, has to be in H01, and therefore it has to vanish on the boundary. Okay, now this vanish on the boundary, we're talking about Lipschitz conditions, let me explain that. If the maximum point has a density, then the linear derivative of the L2 norm at that point will be M0, so it will vanish on the boundary. And so for the smooth test function, if we have a smooth test function, that will mean that we have zero on the boundary linear derivative, which will imply for the solution that we are bounded from above by 2 times delta M0 on the boundary, and which is zero. And then if you put also the super solution property, these two together will imply that, I don't know why I put V here, it's supposed to be U, will imply that du dm will be zero on the boundary. So that we need that condition to put the Neumann condition. As far as I know, that's the first time that one sees this kind of Neumann condition on the infinite dimensional space. And strangely enough, it's the same condition that we're going to see in the problem for the Fleming VO model. So, okay. So here are the motivation of the inequalities in the definition. So this is the formal argument that everybody does to show that this penalization doesn't mess you up. So if we're in a situation where we touch V, which is the potential solution from above, by a test function like that. So now I'm just putting in what we have. So you see here I create a 2 delta term inside the Hamiltonian. I repeat, this is why for the super solution property we need to assume Lipschitz to eliminate that. And we have that term in the linear part that comes from the Laplacian. And you see that if we pull out the term that comes from the M0 Laplacian of M0 times M0, you integrate by parts and you get the H-1 norm, the L2 norm of the gradient, which is the regularizing effect you have. So that's what we have in mind, and that's why we have to be in H01 in order to be able to know that M0 is in L1, to create some compactness by producing the H01 norm in the inequalities. Okay. So that's the main ingenuity, if anything, for the test functions we are using. And now I want to sketch how we can prove the comparison. As I said, we cannot prove the comparison using a smooth function of the type we are using for the definition. We are using the smooth functions in the definition in order to prove the convergence. But when we prove uniqueness, the only way we can do it is by using this rougher test functions, which are C12 in time and the H-1. And of course, in order to be able to do that, we have to show that the definition we have implies that we can use such test functions. I know it's a little bit silly the way I'm describing it, but if we use this definition, if we use this test functions, we cannot prove the convergence, because the convergence comes, these functions are too rough to use them at the finite dimensional level, so we need to use the other one. But what we saw is that if we have a subsolution or a super solution, and now we have a maximum of that quantity, V minus phi minus delta M square, and the phi is a function with this regularity, then indeed we have again that M0 is in H01, and we have the inequality we want. And of course, there is a similar property for the super solution. Okay, I wanted to show you the construction, why this is true. Why is it that if we... So what the point, the proof is based on the elementary fact, although it's 10 pages in the paper, approximately 10 pages, to prove that if we have a function which is rough in that sense, let's say forget the time, it's C2 in H-1 norm, can be approximated by functions which are smooth in our case, which the only difference is that our functions, that the smooth functions have zero derivative of the boundary. Okay, so the claim we make is that through an elaborate process of approximation, we can approximate any function which is in C2 in H minus 1 by smooth functions meaning by functions that are smooth and they have zero linear derivative of the boundary. And you can think a little bit how you do it, but writing it, it's a mess. You have to extend the domain, you have to do something, you have to introduce two parameters in the problem, and then send first one to zero and then the other, and there is no way one can write this thing down on transparency. So the proof, that's the only thing I'm telling you, is the proof is based on the stability properties of the notion of solution and a regularization procedure that allows you to approximate a given function which is C2 in H minus 1 in its derivative by smooth. Smooth, when I say, the only thing is, the additional thing when I say smooth here is that they have linear derivative zero on the boundary. Okay. And why do we use this norm, the H minus 1? Because this norm H minus 1 has exactly that property, because if you compute its, that's why the Fréchet derivative, and if that's f of x, then the relationship is that the f is the unique solution of this PDE with zero Neumann conditions, zero boundary conditions, with the right-hand side m minus n. So that's the property we are going to use about test function. All right. So unfortunately, the hard part I cannot show to you. All right, so how do we prove the comparison? Since I cannot show you the hard part, I have to show you something that is a little bit easier. V minus is a subsolution, V plus is a supersolution in the notation I'm using here. So we are assuming that we argue by contradiction that the sup is strictly positive. And then we penalize by the delta. And because we are in a compact setting, we don't have to do anything fancy here in order to have maximizers, because any optimizing sequence is bounded because of that. And the functional we are trying to maximize is upper semi-continuous respect to the distance. And in the weak topology of VL2, so the maximize out of the maximizing sequence, we can pass to the limit and do prove that there is a maximum on that soup. So the first claim we need to make is that the soup of that will converge to this. One inequality is obvious because of the positivity of the penalty, which is this. And for the other inequality, to prove that m delta in some sense is greater or equal m zero, what we take our maximizer for the m zero problem, we smooth it out through some convolution, we look at it at the bounded domain, and then we go through the usual thing that the m zero being a maximizer is within eta of the right hand side. But now we, on the right-hand side, we can use as a maximizer, so we can put the mk there, and through the sequence of inequalities, which are not a big deal, we can prove that these limits are the same. As a result of that, and that is going to be used later, is that the delta m, if we call m delta the minimizer, the maximizer, delta times the L2 norm of the maximizer goes to zero. And that's an important thing in the end to conclude. Okay, so with double variables, now we know the game. We use the H minus 1 norm here. The same argument I used before guarantees that there is a maximizing point here, m delta epsilon and n delta epsilon. By the definition, because again it's bounded and it has the right continuity, by the definition, we have these maximizers are going to be in H0,1. And as I said, from the maximization, we also know that these quantities are uniformly in epsilon, and they're bounded uniformly in epsilon. Okay. So now we use the fact that this is an H minus one norm, which means that we find the element that solves the unique solution of this problem. And the right hand side is the Gateau derivative of the penalty we introduce, and we write down the two definite, the subsolution and supersolution property, where now we use inside, as was in the definition, the gradient of the f delta. This is the place where formally, when I did the formal argument, I show you can integrate by parts. So we have this inequality from the definition, the same thing for the supersolution. We subtract, and in the end, we get that inequality, which means nothing, apart from the fact that I is like that, two is this way, three is that, and the fourth is just this L2 norm. Okay? Recall the definition of the F delta, so now I'm going to get bounds for each one of these terms. So the first term was just after integration by parts, and that was important. We need to integrate by parts. So the first term, is this. So we can integrate once by parts because we are allowed from the notion of test functions we have. So that term looks like that, and now I just do Holder's inequality to say that the I, we can control it in that form. The linear growth of H, its ellipse is continuous, so the linear growth of H allows us to control the second part, which is written here from above by nice terms. And finally, the ellipsis continuity on F allows us to have this sequence of inequalities. So all these things together, and I know at this point you are willing to buy anything I say, combining all the above, this is the estimate we have. So lambda, which we want to show, it's assumed to be positive, plus this regularizing term is bounded by something that we know from the maximization will have to go to zero as epsilon goes to zero, plus the L2 norm of the penalty. Okay? First I'll send epsilon to zero. This is a typical viscosity solution proof. So I'll send epsilon first to zero and then delta. We know that these are uniformly bounded in epsilon. So the m delta epsilons and n delta epsilons are uniformly bounded in L2, uniformly in delta bounded in epsilon. So we can pass to the limit here as epsilon goes to zero. And using the fact that the double maximum goes to a single maximum, we can prove that the m delta epsilon goes to there. And also, as always in a viscosity proof, the penalty term will go to zero. So if we put everything back in that equation, so we know there is a weak limit here, so this has a limit, we throw away that, because we used it to claim that the maximizers were in at 0, 1. We come down to this inequality, and now, as I said at the beginning, the m deltas go to m0, so that means that goes to 0, which means the lambda is less equal 0, which is a contradiction. So, as soon as you figure out the right test function, I claim the proof of the of comparison is non-standard. So, how do we handle the fact that the Hamiltonian is, we had to assume the Hamiltonian's Lipschitz continuous? what we do is we prove that at least at the level of the approximation, so this hierarchy, we have a uniform Lipschitz bound. As a result, we can truncate the Hamiltonian, we can do the comparison for Lipschitz continuous Hamiltonians, and then let the truncation go to infinity. So the purpose of this thing here is to show you how one can prove a uniform in N Lipschitz bound for the Vn case. Remember, the Vn case, we're solving for each K the usual Hamilton-Jacobi Bellman equation, and all the coupling was on the boundary, where the Vnk on the boundary was equal to the Vnk minus 1, take away one of the coordinates. Okay? So the claim we have is that the VNKs are uniformly bounded, K and M are in between 1 and N, are uniformly Lipschitz continuous in space and Hölder continuous in time in this way. So we have to prove that this is the estimate, so on the hierarchy. And this is done at three steps. The first step is to prove that when you look at the difference between VNK and VNK minus 1, where the only difference is that, that these two are within 1 over n. The second is to construct barriers to control the difference on the boundary. Remember, the domain is smooth. And the third one is to have a pure uniform Lipschitz bound in that norm for each fixed k. So if you take these three things together, one can obtain that, at least for the space continuity. The time continuity comes differently, but it's classical in this case. Okay, let me attempt to show you the sketch of the proof. The first step, it's not difficult, because the only thing you need to do is to elevate the VNK minus 1. Remember, the VNK minus 1 is defined in one space dimension less than the VNK. So you just define a new function here, which is, doesn't see this variable, the XA minus 1, and you compare at the K level. And the difference between the equation satisfied by the VNK and the Vn hat nk minus 1 is this extra term 1 over n times hi, which since h is bounded when you put the gradient 0 by the Lipschitz property we have on the solution, we see that we pick up the 1 over n error. So that's an easy part. To find the Lipschitz estimate for each one of the VNKs, Lipschitz in this D1 type norm, because remember, I have to use such norm because this is the norm where we make all the assumptions at the end, the one Wasserstein, the thing that looks like the one Wasserstein metric. We do some kind of, in theory, to get something like that, you will like to do a Bernstein trick, but it's not going to work, it's not going to give you the D1 norm here. So basically, we are maximizing something like that with the lambda factors a little bit different than the classical proof. And we show that we can choose the lambda in such a way that the maximum of this is less equal 0, and that will imply the estimate we want. And the one with the barriers, I use the one barrier, so you know what you do. You need to show there are barriers, and once you have them, easy to just need to construct the barriers in some way. Okay. The proof that any limit point of the VNKs is the value function is a solution to the PDE. So first of all, I define what it means to be a limit point. So any limit of the VNKs along subsequences converts to V is a limit point if any projection on any subprobability measure like that is approximated by the VNKs. That's the definition you expect. And so now there are two steps in what follows. First of all, we use the fact that we prove Lipschitz bounds for the VNKs, which means that we can truncate the Hamiltonians. Once we truncate the Hamiltonians, which were locally Lipschitz continuous, once we truncate them, they are becoming global Lipschitz, and we can do whatever we want with them. So because the Lipschitz continues, we can truncate at any r with r bigger than the Lipschitz bound. So that's the first step. And for this proof, we have to use the smooth functions, the smooth test functions, the functions that have zero derivative on the boundary, because we need to use them. We need to use that in to take care of the strange boundary condition we have. And at some point during the talk, I made the point that the boundary conditions we have at the finite dimensional space are encaptured at the limit by the fact that the linear derivative of the test function is zero on the boundary. Okay? You don't agree? Okay.
It's slightly misleading.
The comment or what I say? Okay, I had no doubt about that. Okay, so at this point we use this, we use the phi that is a smooth function, and we regularize it because we need to regularize the L2 norm in order to be able to have a smooth test function for the system. And we put the error and we pass the limit. So there is nothing special about that. And the properties of the value function are the usual ones. I state them after a while without the R, but we have to do it all at the level R in order to have the Lipschitz continuity. So we have dynamic programming. We have existence of... there's the issue of the R. So in the end, I want to eliminate the R. So we have existence of maximizers through the forward-backward system. And then for that system, we can prove we have a global Lipschitz solutions, which then allow us to remove the R we had before and do the problem both for the U and the UR. And we prove that the value function has the right uniform continuities. This again, it's not that surprising. It looks takes space to write it, but the time dependence, the Holder continuity in time is classical, and the Lipschitz continuity, it's doing by comparing two different points and using the properties of the equation satisfied by EM. Okay, and once we have all that, it's easy to check that the value function is the unique viscosity solution, and that's the end of it. So now I'm listening to why it's silly. Yeah, I'm done.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.